Hi, everybody. I'm Sam. I'm an editor at Triple Canopy, and we're organizing this event as part of 50 days of events, lectures, discussions. We're calling it Speculations, the Future is Blank. We're asking writers, artists, scientists, political thinkers to describe a future they'd like to see and to generally speak constructively about the future and think about what that means for the present. So coming up the next few days, we're going to be pretty brave. Tomorrow, David Reif is talking about the world food crisis. On Sunday, the novelist Ripley Galchin and Norman Rush are in discussion. Monday, Marie Lorenz, who has work in Expo One, which is the larger show that Speculations is part of. And then on from there, take a calendar, which are out across the hall, and please come back. I'm happy today that we have Adam Cohen here. He's the professor of all the sciences at Harvard. We went to high school together, and so there's like a reunion of the Hunter High School, or college high school science club. In high school, Adam won, I guess maybe it's called Intel now, but the Westinghouse for building an electron microscope was better, whose main structural component was Lego with some modeling clay. And he's built some other things since then, and he'll probably talk about a few of those. So here's Adam to talk about the future.
Thank you, Sam, for that kind introduction and invitation to come talk to you. And thanks all of you for coming here. It's great to see so much of the Hunter High School Science Club here in attendance. So I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the brain and some of the techniques that we in my lab and others are developing, both to study how it works and to control it in order to fix it when it goes wrong, and
maybe you can handle it if you want.
Maybe to make it go.
Or you can also handle it if you want.
So let's start with this picture. This is a picture of the brain of a mouse. Hi, Zoe. So it's a microscopic image, and these neurons have each been genetically modified to contain proteins from a variety of sea creatures found around the world. And these proteins are fluorescent, and they come in all the colors of the rainbow. And so each neuron is lit up in a different color. Now this technique is called the rainbow technique, and it lets scientists trace the connectivity of the neurons in the brain. What we're interested in my lab is not just looking at the connectivity, but looking at the function. Try to actually see neurons fire, to make them light up when they fire. And so I'll tell you a little bit about that. But before we start, we need to talk a little bit about what the brain is. So we all have sort of anecdotal experience with this, right? You have one in your head. And so I want you to take a minute and think about what's going on inside of your head. So in your brain, you have about 100 billion neurons. So that's about 15 times as many neurons as there are people on the planet. And each of those neurons has about 10,000 connections to other neurons, 10 to the 4th synapses. Okay? And your entire mental state is represented inside of this brain. And so here's sort of a microscopic view of some neurons which have been fluorescently labeled and connected to each other. The brain is actually very dense, so there's neurons and other cells all jammed up against each other. Now, these neurons communicate with each other by sending little electrical impulses down the cell. And your entire mental state, so everything you think and feel and believe, is represented in these little electrical spikes traveling down the cells in your brain. So that's it. That's all there is. These spikes, they're about a tenth of a volt high. Okay. So it's a little electrical blip, about a tenth of a volt high, and they last about 1/1000th of a second. So just as in a computer, little electrical ones and zeros are what represent the state of the computer, in your brain, it's the same thing. These little electrical spikes represent the state of your brain. Okay. And the way information gets processed in your brain. So this is taking a century of neuroscience down to a minute or so, is that these signals travel down the axon of the neuron. They go a couple miles an hour. And then when they get to the end, they trigger the release of some chemicals, some neurotransmitters, which diffuse across the synapse and then activate what are called little ion channels on the downstream cell, which then initiate a little electrical blip in that cell. And if a cell gets enough input with just the right timing and location, that will cause that cell to fire a spike, which can then go and activate another 10,000 neurons. Okay? And so these patterns of activity and the ways in which they interact with each other govern everything there is that we do with our nervous system. Okay? And so that's really all there is. And in order to understand the brain, we'd really like to be able to visualize these patterns of activity. We'd like to be able to just look in the brain of a person or a mouse or some other creature and, you know, scratch its tummy and see the ensuing patterns of behavior in the brain. This is sort of trying to get, how many people heard about Obama's brain initiative? A few people. So a couple of weeks ago, President Obama announced a new initiative to develop new kinds of tools for studying how the brain works. And of course, I was very happy about it because that's what we're doing in my lab already. And the main point of what I'm going to tell you today is that it's an extremely exciting time to be involved in neuroscience and biotechnology, because just in the last few years, there's been a convergence of technologies which all of a sudden make it possible for us to really think seriously about getting inside our brain and watching what's going on and tweaking with it and seeing what the effects of perturbations to the brain are. And so I think in the next few years, we're going to see a deluge of new neurotechnologies that enhance the way we understand and control our brains. So, what my lab works on is finding ways to use light both to study and to control the activity of neurons. Okay. And so the story I'll tell you starts here. This is a photo from an airplane. Does anybody know where this is? Yes, sir. Holland. Sadly not. No. Does anybody else want to guess? Are you from Holland?
No, it looks like tulip fields.
It looks like tulip fields. It does look like tulip fields, but it's not. It's actually ponds of drying seawater that are the water being evaporated to make salt. So they're salt ponds. Any other guesses?
San Francisco Bay.
It's San Francisco Bay, that's right. This is a view from an airplane flying into San Francisco Airport. And at the base of San Francisco Bay, or San Jose, there are these ponds where people are drying seawater in order to make salt. Okay, so where do these beautiful colors come from? To see where the colors come from, let's zoom in by a factor of about 10 million. And if you zoom in and look in the water, what you'll find is that there'll be little colored microscopic creatures growing in the water. Okay, and these creatures are what give the water the color that you can see from the airplane. Now let's zoom in by another factor of 10,000 and look at the molecules that are imparting the color to these creatures. Inside the skin, inside the membranes of these single-celled organisms, there are these proteins called microbial rhodopsins, the rhodopsin proteins. And these are the proteins that give the color that you can see from here. These proteins are actually very similar to the proteins in our eyes that we use for vision. So when we look around, there's a protein in our eye that absorbs sunlight and triggers a biochemical response, which then triggers our retina, and that's how we see. These creatures have similar proteins, which they use both to capture energy from sunlight and to sense sunlight, so they know when to swim up toward the surface in order to get more oxygen and when to swim down deeper into the water. So it turns out this is just one class of protein that's found in creatures that live in the wild. And there are thousands of varieties of these rhodopsin proteins. And they come in all the colors of the rainbow. And they mediate a huge variety of interactions between sunlight and different biological processes. So there are ones that act like little solar cells, little photovoltaics. They convert sunlight into electricity. There are others that absorb sunlight and generate different signaling processes inside of the cells. Now, a few years ago, some friends of mine had this idea that they were going to take the genes for these proteins that are found in these microorganisms that live in San Francisco Bay and elsewhere, and take these little pieces of DNA and put them into other kinds of creatures, into other organisms, and thereby impart light sensitivity to these other creatures. So the idea is, if you take a gene from, say, this little single-celled creature, which is called Chlamydomonas, and you put it into the brain of a mouse, then when you shine light on the neurons in the brain of this mouse, you can alter its behavior. Or if you put it into a worm, you can alter the worm's behavior. Or if you put them into a virus, you can then infect some other creature with this virus. The virus will deliver the DNA to another creature, and then when the creature sees the DNA, it'll start producing protein, and it will become responsive to light. So this is laser mining. So let me give you some examples. The first one is from a friend of mine who was studying a little worm called C. elegans. So these worms are about the size of a grain of rice, and they're not very clever. They only have 302 neurons. Okay? Every one of these worms has 302 neurons. And what he did is he genetically modified these worms with one of these proteins, so that it expressed this protein in a particular neuron in its body. And he had this worm crawling around. And then he built a little laser tracking system to follow the worm as it crawled around and to stimulate different neurons inside the body of the worm. Okay. And so I'll show you a video of this. So here's this worm. The little blue bar here shows where he was targeting the light onto the body of the worm. So now let's zoom ahead a little bit. And at some point, he's going to hit the neuron responsible for egg laying. And you see those two little eggs just pop out the side of the worm. And then it'll stimulate it again, and another egg will come out. And so by zapping this worm with a laser, he can make the worm lay an egg on command. Okay? And this is because the worm has been genetically modified. It has one neuron that's responsible for controlling the muscle that lays eggs. And that neuron has been modified to become light. So this is great, and this is lots of practical applications. Okay, let me show you another example. So this is a mouse, and another friend of mine has taken the gene for this light-sensitive protein and put it into a virus. And then when this mouse was young, he injected the virus into the mouse's brain. And so then this virus delivered the DNA, and the neurons in a particular region of the mouse's brain became sensitive to light. And so then he did a little surgery where he put an optical fiber going through the skull of the mouse. And you can turn on a laser and control the behavior of the mouse. Because this mouse is in a little bucket, in this case the gene is in its motor cortex. And when the light goes on, the mouse starts running in circles. You see the little blue light? And it'll keep running in circles as long as the laser is on. And then when the laser goes off, it will return to its previous behavior. Great. By the way, you should interrupt if there's any questions or comments about this. And you can come in. You don't need to hang out on the edge, if, or not. Yeah. All right. Let me just show you one more example of laser mind control. So this is another mouse which has had this virus injected into its brain in the region of the brain responsible for controlling aggression. And so this mouse is in a cage, and there's a little rubber glove here which has been inflated and put in the cage. And normally a mouse will come up to the glove, explore a little bit, and then ignore it. Here there's an optical fiber going into the mouse's brain. And you see what happens when the light goes on. So the mouse attacks the glove. And then when the light goes off, it's stops and goes back to its previous behavior. And then at some point the light will come back on. And it attacks again. And then the light goes off and it stops back. So why are people doing this? Besides, you know, it's sort of amazing to see that you can do this. This tells us about which areas of the brain are involved in regulating different behaviors, like aggression. And of course, aggression is not just limited to mice. This is something that's also relevant to people. And we'd like to know when somebody shows, for instance, apparent aggressive behavior. We'd like to know something about the biological underpinnings of this behavior. And so this is a way to learn about how these behaviors are regulated. And there's a great many things you can make mice do now with light. So you can make them go to sleep, you can make them wake up, you can make them eat, turn left or right, and so on. Okay. So one medical application of this is there's a form of blindness where the retina degenerates. And people have now introduced these genes into the eyes of mice that have this form of blindness and been able to restore vision in these mice. So the experiment is simple. You put a mouse in a maze where there's one exit, and you shine a light at that exit, and all the other exits are dark. And for a mouse that can see, it learns extremely quickly to associate the light with the exit, and it just gets out. For a blind mouse, it never learns, of course, because it can't see the light. But for these mice where you've injected this virus into their eyes, they regain the ability to locate the light and to find the exit. And there are now clinical trials happening in people to use this as a therapy for this form of blindness. So now I'm going to tell you about some work from my lab using a gene from a microorganism from here. Does anybody know where this is? Utah. It could be Utah. It is a very salty lake, but it's not a great salt lake. This is the Dead Sea, okay, in Asia. And there's a creature here which uses a little protein to capture solar energy from something. It uses one of these proteins. And in my lab, we were interested in the question of whether we could run these proteins in reverse. So I showed you how you could use these proteins to convert light into a pattern of activity in a neuron. Right? Light comes in, they generate this electrical disturbance, which then can cause a neuron to fire. And so I became interested in the question of, could we instead use the firing of a neuron to induce an optical signal that we could see? So instead of having light in and neural activity come out, can we have neural activity be the stimulus and light come out that we can see in a microscope? And this is sort of a cartoon of what this protein looks like. So this is a molecular structure. This represents the membrane of the cell, and this protein sits in the membrane. And okay, so now I'm going to skip 3 years of extremely hard work and tell you that yes, this works. So we identified and engineered this protein from this creature that lives in the Dead Sea, and we got it to convert electrical activity into a fluorescent signal that we can see in the microscope. So I'll show you what that looks like. So this is a picture of a human tumor cell where we introduced the gene for this protein into the cell. And so the cell started producing the protein, and we're looking at the glow from this protein. And you can't see it in the picture, but we have a little electrode jammed into the cell. And I'll show you a movie where we apply steps of voltage, so we turn the voltage on and off in the cell, and we look at the glow from the cell. And this is what we see. So as the voltage goes up, the cell lights up, and as the voltage goes down, the cell gets dark. And so this was very exciting. This was the first time anybody had been able to do this. So then we wanted to look at neurons. We wanted to see if we put the gene for this protein into a neuron, and we see the neuron fire. And so we needed to get some neurons. And the way we did that is we went online There's a company called brainbits.com where you can mail order a live rat brain, FedEx overnight to your doorstep. It's shipped on this. So anybody with a credit card, $120, you can get a rat brain shipped to you. Okay? So we got some rat brains, and we mushed them up, and cultured the neurons in a dish. So the neurons are still alive, and they can grow in a little petri dish. And then we took this gene, and we put it into a virus. It's actually a variant of the HIV virus, but it's no longer effective to people. And we introduced it into these neurons, so they got the genetic material, and they started producing this protein. And then we looked in the dish, and the neurons were fluorescent. And then we used a little electrode to stimulate the neuron. And we took a very high-speed video of the neuron when we stimulated it. And so this is a video at 1,000 frames per second of a rat neuron in the dish. And so this is what we saw. And so this is the first time anyone had taken a movie of a neuron firing using a genetically encoded tool like this. Okay? So it's a neuron with a gene of dead seed microorganism, and now because of that, it emits flashes of fluorescence. So we've now been taking this genetic tool that we need, this reporter of electrical activity in cells, and putting it everywhere we can think of. Because there's neurons and other electrically active cells all over life. And we're interested to start to look around to see what we can see. And so one species that we like to work with a lot are little fishies called zebrafish. And we like these fishies because they're very small and they're transparent. And so you can look inside of the creature and you can see all of its organs, and you don't have to do any surgery to see them. So we genetically modify these fish, we edit their genomes to have these genes that report their activity. And then we grow them up and we take the whole fish, live animal, and we plug it down on a microscope and we look and see what we can see. So here's an example of a genetically modified fish, which has this reporter protein in its part, right here. And you can see its part is lit up green. And so then we built a microscope to make three-dimensional reconstructions of the electrical activity in the part. So just as our brains are electrically regulated, so too are our hearts. You have a pacemaker which generates this electrical impulse which travels over your heart.
But regulates its activity. So here's an example of a three-dimensional reconstruction of a zebrafish heart. Our hearts have four chambers, fish only have two chambers. So it's the atrium, which is in front, and the ventricle in the back. And so we can now see how this activity travels over the heart of the fish. What we're working on now is trying to watch this organ develop. So when the fish starts as an egg, it's just one cell. And then it becomes a collection of cells, none of which are a heart. And then eventually it has a heart. And so at some point, this organ has to boot up. It has to go from a collection of cells that are inactive to a collection of cells that are synchronized and beating. And we want to see, how does this organ get started? How do the cells collectively organize their behavior? In hearts, both fish and human, this electrical impulse, which synchronizes the heartbeat, then leads to a flux of an ion, calcium, into the heart. And it's this calcium which is what actually makes the muscle contract. And so we were interested to look at the calcium as well as the voltage in the heart, because these tell us different things about the physiology of the fish. So we made a new gene, which is a hybrid of a couple of different genes. It involves our voltage reporting gene from this creature that lives in the Dead Sea. This is a single-celled microorganism. Fused to another gene derived from a jellyfish, which is also a fluorescent protein. Fused to another gene derived from a chicken, which is sensitive to calcium. Okay, so we took these genes from these three different creatures, stapled them together in just the right way. And now we have something where in red, it reports on the firing, the electrical activity in the heart. And in blue, it reports on calcium, okay? And so we call this protein caviar. It's stands for calcium and voltage indicator, okay? And then we put caviar in fish. So we have fish which have this caviar reporter in their hearts. And so I'll show you what this looks like. So here voltage is on the top and calcium is on the bottom, and you can see these waves propagating over the heart in the fish. So what about fish brains? We're also interested in looking in the brain of fish. And we haven't quite gotten this to work yet, but we've started to make transgenic fish where we can see at least the structure of the neurons in the brain of the fish. And so I'll show you a movie where we fly through the brain of a live fish. So this is starting at the top of the fish. And as we go through, you can see every cell is lit up. Here's the nose of the fish. Here's an eye, the retina. Here's the other eye. And then there's the optic nerves at the back of the fish. Okay? This is taken inside of a live fish. And we're working now to develop the tools so that we can tickle the tail of the fish or something and see these neurons light up as they fire. Some other labs have made a little bit of progress in this direction. And so I'll show you some movies of the inside of fish brains, where people are looking not at the electrical activity in the cells, but at calcium, which is also has fluxes associated with neurons firing. So this is a picture of a zebrafish brain. And here, so one eye is over here and the other eye is here, and you can see these neurons and you can see them light up as this brain is, as the fish is looking at things in its environment. Here's another movie where, let me just pause it and explain what's going on here. So on the bottom here is a fish, and we can see the patterns of activity in its brain, so it lights up wherever it's firing. And in front of this fish, there's a little paramecium, a little piece of food, which is swimming around, and this fish is watching this food swim in front of it. And you have to remember that in the eyes, the left eye is connected to the right half of the brain, and the right eye is connected to the left half of the brain. So as this paramecium, as this little creature swims around in front of the fish, you'll see the opposite side of the brain light up as the fish sees this creature. Oops. Okay. So whichever way that paramecium swims, you see the fish light up, brain light up on the other side. Okay. So you can actually see this fish looking at its dinner. Great. I'll show you one more movie. So this, just to give you a sense of the timing, so this was published in February of this year. So this is basically the state of the art as of now. So that's now, there was just a publication from another friend of mine who is now looking in three dimensions at the entire fish brain and imaging activity throughout the brain of the fish. So this is a picture again of the fish brain. Here's its nose. And then here's two cross sections through the brain. And so this is what we can see these days. So you can see the patterns of activity as all the different neurons fire inside the brain of this fish. Good. All right. So so far I've told you a little bit about tools for visualizing activity in the brain. Now, at the beginning, I showed you these mice where with blue light targeted into the brain, people could control their behavior, right? You could activate neurons. And so starting about a year ago in my lab, we decided to combine this laser mind control, the activation of the neurons, with the imaging in order to see the neurons fire. And so the idea would be to use one kind of laser to stimulate the brain and another kind of laser to record from the brain, okay? And so working with a friend of mine at MIT named Ed Boyden, we developed a tool to do this. And the way it works is we put the genes into neurons for two different proteins. One of them is this protein that's activated by blue light. When you shine blue light on it, it causes the neuron to fire. And one of them is our protein from this Dead Sea microorganism, where when the neuron fires, we see a flash of red light, okay? So now the idea is we'll shine a flash of blue light on the cell, make it fire, and then when the cell fires, we'll see a flash of red fluorescence, just like that, okay? And so you see this works in PowerPoint, and so that's very encouraging, okay? It actually also works in real life. So here's an example of sort of what this data looks like. So here, each blue bar represents a flash of blue light delivered to a single neuron. And every time we flash light on the cell, it produces this flash of red fluorescence, so it lights up. And then we recorded the electrical signal at the same time just for ground truth to check that this actually works. And so you can see this correspondence that as the cell fires, we see these flashes of light from it, okay? So we can stimulate with blue light and record with red light. Now, we're doing this in a microscope. And so I thought it would be neat if we could target the blue light to some subcellular region, to a little piece of the cell. And that way we could then trigger the cell and then watch this impulse propagate through the cell. So we needed a way to deliver a little flash of blue light to a subcellular region. And the way we did that is we hacked a video projector. So we took a projector, just like the one that's displaying this image, and we reconfigured it so that instead of projecting a big image onto a screen, it projects a pattern of light onto the cells in the microscope. So wherever we want light to excite a cell, we can basically display an image, and wherever the image shows light, the cell will get stimulated. Okay. So just to demonstrate that this works, we downloaded a video from YouTube and played it into the microscope, and then recorded what we saw inside the microscope. Okay. So I'm not sure the contrast here will show this so well, but I'll try this. So. You have to figure the contrast. What you're supposed to be able to see there is a juggling clown. So here's his head, and here are his hands. And this is a view inside of the microscope. And a single cell would be about this big on the scale. Okay, so we can target the blue light to any piece of a cell in any pattern of space and time that we want. Okay?
So is that one or multiple cells that can be clouded?
So here, there's no cells in this picture yet. We just have a fluorescent, basically a film in the microscope. And we're just projecting the light from this pattern onto the cells. And now we're going to put cells in there and see what happens. Okay. So here's an example. So here are two neurons in the microscope. And we're going to target the blue light, which is going to make them fire, right here. Okay. So we're going to stimulate this cell. And what's going to happen is you're going to see this cell is going to start to fire. And then it's going to trigger this downstream cell because there's going to be a little signal that goes across the synapse between the cells. And so this is at 1,000 frames a second. And so that's what's going on inside of your brain as you sit and think or do anything. There are these impulses which light up one cell and then hop across the synapse and then will light up other cells. And this happens in 100 trillion cells about 1,000 times a second, and that's your brain, okay? So we're interested in using this to try to study molecules that can affect how the brain works. So for instance, just to demonstrate this, we added a drug that blocks the synapse. So it prevents the downstream cell from being activated by the upstream cell. So now if you look at the cell body on the downstream cell, you'll see that the upstream cell fires, but the downstream cell then doesn't have a response. Okay. So this is a tool now for testing different drugs and different compounds to see how they would affect the activity of these cells in the dish, and then the hope is, by extension, the activity of cells in our brain. Great. All right, so I'll show you just one more movie related to this. We've developed some tricks for imaging with very, very high resolution in time. So to map very precisely how signals propagate through a neuron. So this is a movie, this is a picture of a single neuron, and we're optically stimulating it right here at the body of the cell. And this will be a movie at 100,000 frames per second, showing how an impulse moves through a neuron. And so this is what we see. So you can actually use this technology really to map how signals move through neurons. Okay. Any questions about this?
What about the clown?
What about the clown? So the clown was just to show that we could put the light wherever we want. Here, yeah. So now we're using that same technology to put the light right here, and then that's triggering the neuron to fire. Yeah, well, so you can do things as complicated as you want. I have no idea what would happen if we put the clown on the neuron. It might think it's funny. Who knows? Yeah. Good. Other questions? Yeah.
Oh.
So the question is, how did we end up using these particular genes from this creature from the Dead Sea? Yeah, so of course, in science, the way things happen is never, that's how the salami gets made. And it was through a sort of circuitous route. We were actually trying some other experiments with those particular proteins, which we worked on for 2 years, and they completely failed. We didn't have any positive results from those experiments. And so I was trying to figure out what we could do with all this infrastructure we had built and all the knowledge we had learned about these proteins from these failed experiments. And I knew that imaging brain function was something a lot of people were interested in. And it occurred to me that we might be able to take these proteins and run them in reverse and use them for this attribute. There are other people who are working on other kinds of technologies for imaging brain function. So for instance, you mentioned cadmium selenide. So there are these, you can make tiny nanocrystals out of this material and they're fluorescent. And there are people who are trying to use those to image brain function too. There's a lot of different strategies that are out there. It turns out that so far this has worked the best of all the different strategies people are trying. And that's probably luck.
Is the reason why you're using other kinds of source to heighten, the particles to make them, like,
happen? So the question of why this is useful is interesting. Part of what makes this so useful is that this tool we're using to make the neurons light up is a protein, which means that if you put DNA into a cell, then the cell produces the protein on its own, and so it lights up like this. And so by using these protein-based tools, we can target the protein to many different cell types, to any cell type we want, by encoding within the DNA the instructions for where and when to produce the protein. If you're going to use something inorganic, non-biological, like a nanocrystal, then you have to target it yourself, and that's actually very hard to do. So by using these genetic tools and getting the animals to do the work for you, you can take advantage of a lot of the evolved machinery which is already in place in these organisms. Does that answer your question? Great. Other questions? Yes, sir.
This sort of ultra slow motion thing you're doing, are you actually recording this very short span of time?
So this is not raw data. This is highly processed data. And so we run the experiment hundreds of times over and then computationally reconstruct what the pattern of propagation would have been, and we take this. There is no camera that can run at 100,000 frames a second. We have basically the best camera that money can buy, and it can go at 1,000 frames a second, but that's still 100 times too slow to see this. So we have to use computational tricks as well. Yeah. All right, so yes. Oh, yeah, we're doing fine. Go ahead.
Okay. All right. So I had a question relating to flow, light being pointed at the brains to activate something. I was wondering how exactly the differences in the color of the light make a difference, whether that is in some way a parallel, whether it's frequency or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Great.
To the natural sort of currents that happen.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so the question is, how does the color of the light affect the outcome of these experiments? So naturally, the brain is not sensitive to light. If you shine a laser into any of our brains, not much will happen. But then people put in these different proteins which absorb light of a particular color, and when they absorb the light, they activate the brain. Different versions of these proteins from different species around the world happen to absorb different colors. And so you have to match the color of the light you put in to the color of the protein you're trying to activate. Yeah.
The question about viruses introduced. I've always kind of been a little bit confused. Like, how targeted is it?
Right. So the question is, how targeted are these viral gene delivery strategies? And the answer is, it can be either. So there's different strategies. You can either inject the virus into a particular region and only modify that region, or you can make a transgenic organism where the gene is in every cell in the body, but it might only get turned on in a particular cell type. Ah, so these viruses have been modified so that they're no longer infectious. So they don't replicate. They only infect once, and then instead of having so a virus replicates by having containing the genetic code to make more viruses. We've replaced that genetic code with the genetic code to make our proteins. So these viruses cannot replicate on their own. That's why it's safe for us to work with them also. That's why we're not all glowing and lit up in the lab. Right. So I just want to make a side comment about these molecular tools that we're working with. So this gene, this combination of genes that we've been using to optically stimulate and record from neurons, combines genes from creatures from all over the world. And these genes originally evolved for totally different purposes than the ones that we're using them from. So our construct, which we use to optically stimulate and record from neurons, has one gene from this microorganism that lives in the Dead Sea. It's fused to another gene for a fluorescent protein from a jellyfish. This other gene comes from this microorganism, which lives in a freshwater pond in the south of England. And it's fused to another gene from a coral that lives in the ocean. And the only reason we can do the things we're doing is because over the last 30 or 40 years, ecologists have been going out, finding these creatures and classifying them and describing the proteins that are in them. And now there are a long list of these things, and we can just go look them up and take the sequences for the different things we want to use. And it's really amazing to me that you can take these genes from these creatures, which had nothing to do with neurons, nothing to do with humans, and assemble them and come up with these new functions which never existed before in the history of evolution. It's also a powerful argument both for conserving these places, because we would never be able to design these genes on our own. We can only get them by finding them in nature, and for supporting the basic research into these organisms, without which we wouldn't have any of the raw materials that we use as our paints for painting these colors. Okay? All right. So I've been talking so far about experiments on mice and on fish. So now I'm going to tell you a little bit about experiments on human cells. Okay? So we're going to move up the food chain and now work on humans. And so I wanted to do some experiments on human heart cells to look at the beating of human heart cells. And so I asked my students if anybody would volunteer to donate their heart for our research. And strangely, nobody offered. And so we needed to find another way to get human heart cells. And so we just went online again and bought some human heart cells over the internet. And now these aren't taken out of any living person's heart. They're derived from stem cells. And so I'm going to tell you about how you can do this, how you can, anybody here with a credit card can go and buy some human heart over the internet. And this is how it works. So in us, all of the cells in our body are pretty much genetically identical. They all have the same information in their genome. The only thing that distinguishes different cell types, our heart from our skin, from our brain, is which genes are turned on. So different pieces of the genome are used in different cell types, but the information is there for the whole person in every cell. Over the last few years, people have figured out how to take some, for instance, skin cells from a person, and to reprogram them, to take them back through embryonic development, back into a fetal state, where they become pluripotent, and then to take them forward through development down a different pathway into a different cell type. Okay? So you can take some skin from a person and make what are called these induced pluripotent stem cells, and then take them forward and make any other cell type. And so, for instance, you can make these cells into cardiac cells, heart cells, and you can grow them in a dish, and they'll start to beat spontaneously in the dish. and you can look at them, and they're genetically identical to the cells in the heart of the person who gave the skin. And so this doesn't really hurt the person much. I have to give a little bit of skin, but it's not a big deal. And so now for the first time, we can study human hearts in a dish. And we can do this either from healthy people or from people with genetically based heart diseases, genetically based cardiac diseases. And we can compare the behavior of these cells in the dish. Okay? And so here's an example. Oops. So this is a human heart cell where it's expressing this gene from this Dead Sea organism. And it's in a dish, and it's beating spontaneously. And so this is what we see. See if this can work. So as the cell beats, we see it emit these flashes of light. Okay? And so this lets us now monitor the behavior of this heart cell. And we can do this on healthy people or diseased people. And then we can spill drugs on these cells and see, to try to identify drugs that will make the cells from the sick person look like the cells from a healthy person. And so this is a cell derived from a healthy person. We're also working now in my lab with cells derived from sick people. So for instance, we're growing cells from a 18-year-old woman who died from heart failure, from a genetic condition. And even though she died, she donated these cells before she died, and the cells are still growing and beating in a dish in our lab, and we're doing experiments on them. So here's just another movie of a heart cell. This is, again, the voltage. And then we've also looked at the calcium signaling in these cells. And we add different drugs to see how the drugs affect the behavior of the cells. So I'll just give you an example here. So the way to read these graphs are, these are plots. Blue is the calcium in the cell, and red is the voltage. And then we add different drugs to different concentrations, and we see what the effect is. So for instance, wobane is a drug that makes the heart beat stronger. And you can see here, as you add more wobane, the amplitude of these calcium signals gets bigger, which corresponds to more powerful contractions of the muscle, until you add too much of the drug. Yes?
How can you be sure that the reporter proteins aren't changing
the output? That's a great question. So how do we know we're not messing things up by putting in these genes from all these strange creatures? So we have to do a whole bunch of control experiments where we compare the behavior of cells with these genes to the behavior of cells without the genes. And so we look at other things besides the activity of these reporter proteins, like activity of other genes, or there's other ways to make electrical measurements. And so, yeah, that's something we have to check. And if we do it wrong, we can definitely mess things up, and we put a lot of work into trying to figure out how to do it in a non-perturbative way. But that's an important question. Yeah. Other questions?
Can you, all these proteins, remember before you were saying that you take strawberry DNA and make a lot of it?
Uh-huh.
Can you, extract a lot of this and have it in a much pump and shine a light at it and it will, grow?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So you can purify these proteins. You can put them in a test tube, shine a laser at it, and see it glow. So you can get as much of the stuff as you like. We're actually making now, so we have growing up in my lab, a transgenic fish which expresses these proteins in every cell in its body. And so our hope is that as these fish swim around, they'll be fluorescent, to shine light at them and they'll glow. And then you'll be able to see, for instance, in their muscles, as they swim, you'll be able to see the muscles light up as they activate. And so that's something I'm very excited to look at. All right. So these are heart cells. Here, just another example where we added a drug that blocks the calcium channels, right? And you can see it blocks the calcium. So we're now working with different pharmaceutical companies to use these tools to screen for drugs to treat different forms of heart disease. And we're doing this in human cells. We're also interested in neuropsychiatric diseases. So just as you can take some skin from a person and make heart cells, you can also take skin from a person and make neurons. And these neurons are genetically identical to the neurons in the person's brain. And so you can study the effects of genetic influences on these neurons. These are newborn neurons, so they have none of the environmental influences, none of the history that the person has lived through. It's just pure genetics. And you can see how the genetic background of these cells affects their behavior. Okay? And again, you can do this from a healthy person, Or you can do this from a person who has schizophrenia or autism or depression or a degenerative disease like multiple sclerosis or Alzheimer's or Parkinson's disease. And you can look at these cells and then try to understand both the mechanism of the disease, so what's wrong in these diseases. We know very little about how these diseases actually work. And then you can test drugs. You can spill drugs on them and see what the effect of the drug is. Yeah, sorry. Ah, that's a great question. So one issue with these cells is they're really newborn. So even if you take the DNA from an old person, aging is an effect not predominantly in the genome. It's predominantly in the way the genes are expressed. And so if you make a newborn neuron, will it show the symptoms of the disease? And so for instance, for Alzheimer's or Parkinson's, these typically set in when people are 60, 70, 80 years old. And so you might ask, if you have a newborn neuron, will it show the symptoms? Nobody knows. So for many of these diseases, we don't really know. So for instance, for somebody who's going to, say, develop Parkinson's disease, we don't know if the disease only process only turns on when the person is in their 60s or 70s, or if the disease is acting from a much earlier age, but you have to accumulate a certain amount of damage before you see the symptoms of the disease. We just don't know. And the problem is that's an impossible experiment to do in people, because if somebody dies and you look in their brain, well, you can see whether or not there's symptoms, but you don't know what the outcome would have been. And there's no way to look inside the brain of a live person at this level of resolution right now. So the other possibility is to try to develop models where you can sort of accelerate the aging of the cells in the dish. Because of this uncertainty, we're starting with severe diseases that tend to manifest at birth. So things like autism and Down syndrome and some forms of epilepsy, which manifest right away. Again, schizophrenia is another example where it would be harder to know, because that tends to set in when people are in their 20s, and we don't know if there's cumulative damage throughout the first two decades of life or if there's some switch in early adulthood. Yeah, great. So so we've just started growing human neurons in a dish. This is all from the last few years. So the Nobel Prize in Physiology and Medicine this year went to the people who discovered how to make these human neurons and these other stem cell-derived cells. And that technology was invented in 2007, and just basically now, people are starting to grow all these cells in the dish and to try to correlate their behavior with the behavior of people to answer questions like this. And so one of the big challenges in this field is the difficulty of recording from the neurons, of knowing what they're doing. Because if you look at a neuron, if you just look at it, you can't see what it's doing any more than I can see what the voltage is in this wire just by looking at it. And so these genetic tools that we've developed now convert the activity into light, and so finally we can see what the cells are doing. So this is an example of a human neuron in a dish. And we're optically stimulating it, and we're watching these impulses travel. Okay? And so I've set up a company now to use these technologies for the purpose of trying to develop new drugs for both neuropsychiatric and cardiac diseases. And so the idea is that we're going to take these different fluorescent reporters and combine them with the stem cell models of diseases and use this to try to identify the mechanisms of these diseases and to test drugs. Basically, in order to discover a therapy, you have to test hundreds of thousands or millions of compounds and see what the effect on the cell is. And so you need some relatively easy way to measure what the cells are doing. And I mean, it's remarkable to me that this is all based on these genes from these Dead Sea creatures and all these creatures from all over the world, and you can just put these together and now have them in humans. I think the people who discovered these genes 30 and 40 years ago never would have guessed that their work would have anything to do with schizophrenia or autism or depression or other neuropsychiatric diseases. And so it's very hard to predict how basic research will pan out, but were it not for the basic research, we wouldn't be able to do this. All right, so that's what I wanted to tell you about. Of course, I work with a lot of different people. Particularly want to mention Ed Boyden at MIT, who has discovered a lot of these genes. and Florian Engert, who's a collaborator in the biology department at Harvard. And, you know, in science, like in any sport, credit really goes to the athletes more than to the coach. And I'm basically the coach in my lab, and I work with some extremely talented scientific athletes. And so their names are on the right over there. And particularly Joel Krall started this project in my lab, and then Adam Douglas and Daniel Hochbaum have taken a lot of the data that I showed you today. And this is a photo of my lab. These are genetically modified t-shirts. And I'm happy to take questions. Thank you. What's that? Oh, yes, that's Andrew Sherlock. Yes, sir.
On the previous slide, I saw that Cassie Darpa is one of the organizations you have
now. Yeah.
Is the military interested in this group? I'm thinking especially about that slide, the video of the mice.
Yeah. In humans. It's a great question. So, before I answer that question, I should mention there's one other group which I forgot to thank, which is all of you for paying taxes, because that's where the funding for all of this comes from, right? So these are mostly federal agencies which fund this research. And so we get funding from the NIH, the National Institute of Health, the National Science Foundation, the Navy, and DARPA. And so the question is, why is the military interested in this? And they're not really interested in making killer mice or genetically modified humans. So I should say that these tools that we've developed, that, for instance, for controlling behavior in mice, are quite a long way from application in humans. And the reason is that the genetic modifications that you have to make can mess up aspects of the genome and can cause tumors and other undesired side effects. And we haven't really figured out how to address that. When you do these experiments in mice, that doesn't really matter, but it would be too risky to do any of this in humans. The interest of the Department of Defense in this is for many different reasons. There are many soldiers who come back with neurological damage, either from psychiatric, from post-traumatic stress disorder, or physical, from what's it called? There's a name for it. The shocks, basically, when your brain gets rattled too much, or from damage to the nerves. And so they're interested in trying to figure out how do you address and treat these problems. They're interested in understanding basic aspects of, for instance, sleep and wakefulness and alertness, and how what's the underlying biology of these things. And so, in fact, these days, a lot of basic research is funded by the military, much of it without direct military applications, but it's towards sort of improving technology generally, which will increase the overall stability and security in the country. They, of course, do fund other research that's more directly related to weapons and combat-related issues, but that's not what this particular program is. Great, yeah.
Building on something you just said about military leaders, sleep and wakefulness. You mentioned in the questionnaire you pulled out before this, which anyone can fill out in the other room, the idea that these technologies can possibly be used for optimization of the brain or, other kinds of evolution that aren't Darwinian and so on. And I was just kind of curious your thoughts. Expand along those lines. Because, obviously, if you didn't have to sleep, that would be great, I guess. But just any kind of expansion and speculation along those lines.
Okay, right. So the question is, how are you going to get this into humans and what's it going to do? Yeah. Right? And I think there's going to be several steps to this process. Initially, we will be screening on human-derived cells in a dish. So when you have cells in a dish, you can do anything you want to them. You don't have to worry about, these ethical issues because it just cells in a dish. And you can use that to understand the basic biology that's going on inside of a person. And that understanding is the foundation upon which any efforts to change the way the brain works to change neural function. And so you can learn about how the brain responds to different environmental influences, how people learn, you know, how psychology works. You can use it to test drugs and to try to identify conventional medicines, to basically do a better job identifying medicines that can either repair the brain when it's malfunctioning or improve its function under natural conditions. And so that's going to be the first thing. It's going to be an adjuvant to conventional drug discovery. Another area that people are interested in, but that's a little bit more difficult, is towards trying to repair the brain directly when things go wrong. And there's two possibilities here. One is to take these stem cell-derived neurons, to take stem cells from somebody's skin, and you can edit the genome of these stem cells to, for instance, correct a genetic mutation which is causing a disease. You can then either directly re-implant those stem cells into a person's brain and hope that they form neurons, or you can differentiate those cells into neurons in a dish and then re-implant those neurons into a person and hope that they reintegrate into the circuitry. And so the idea there is that by doing it with a person's own cells, you don't have to worry about, for instance, immune rejection, right? Because you're not going to have an immune response that you would have to somebody else's cells. And you might be able to correct defects. And so there's ongoing work, for instance, trying to repair spinal cord injuries for people who've become paralyzed, say, from combat or other accidents, to inject stem cells into the spinal cord and have them reincorporate so that you can restore motility to a person. There's challenges here associated with making sure that the genetic modifications don't accidentally make the cells cancerous. That's basically the big issue. Because you have to make the cells, neurons don't normally divide. If you're going to start growing these cells in a dish, you have to start them dividing again, and you have to make sure that shuts off before you put them back in the person, otherwise you've given the person a cancer. And so that's going to take a little bit longer. Even further downstream is using some of these technologies for editing the genomes, but not doing it in cells that we've taken out of the person, but doing it directly inside of the person. And in the earlier session, I mentioned some new tools just developed in the last few months, which make it very easy to edit genomes, to change genomic behavior, to change genes. And so people are all of a sudden starting to think quite seriously about injecting viruses into people's brains that have the tools that will target and edit aspects of a person's genome in the neurons in the person's brain, and for instance, correct things like the defects associated with Huntington's disease so that you could prevent somebody from developing that disease. And so that's also coming down the road. Another aspect of this is the question of trying to correlate the genome with the behavior of the neurons in the dish with the behavior of the person, right? So many different genes interact in very complicated ways in order to determine how our neurons behave. One of the other things that's missing when we have the neurons in the dish, besides their history, is the connectivity. It's not a brain, it's just a neuron. And so we don't have all of the wiring that you have in a brain. So then you also have the neurons in the dish which wire up in a very complicated way in a brain to determine behavior. And so we'd like to figure out what are the places where the genes act, what are the places where wiring matters, what are the places where wiring doesn't matter. And so we'll start to look at ever more subtle aspects of human behavior and start to ask about the cellular and ultimately genetic underpinnings of those aspects of behavior. And so over time, we'll get better precision in understanding what aspects of behavior are determined by environmental influences, what are determined by the way the cells are wired in the brain, which might or might not have a genetic basis. It could also be due to environmental influences, and what's really due to genetic influences. And these will undoubtedly be extremely complicated and case-specific. So in some cases, it'll be largely genetic, and in other cases, largely environmental. Well, I think, so right now viruses are being considered for use in gene therapy. one of the challenges also is the immune response, right? If you have an immune response, that can then damage the cells that are infected with the virus, and so you have to be careful about that. In the late 90s, there was a lot of interest in gene therapy, and people tried, there were some clinical trials using viruses, and they went very poorly. Some people died during these trials, and so that put a stop to that. Since then, the technology has gotten a lot better, and now people are reconsidering sort of reactivating this effort, and the hope is it'll go better the second time around. And I think it's likely to go better. So, so the idea would be to develop viruses and inject them into people, and then that would deliver these genes. In terms of symbiosis with other organisms, basically these viruses will contain within them the genes from jellyfish and dead sea creatures and all sorts of other creatures, bacteria, and introduce these genes into the cells and then imbue new hybrid properties to the cells.
Maybe one more question and we'll wrap up.
Yes, sir.
You showed that picture of the cell firing the other cell. Was that in a dish?
That was in a dish.
So were they unconnected or did they arrange like that?
Yeah. Great question. So the question is, how do these cells find each other and wire up? So neurons are biologically programmed to look for other neurons and to make synapses. And so when, for that experiment, when we mushed up the brain of the rat, we broke all the connections. And then we threw the cells down in a dish, and then we grew them in the dish for about 2 weeks. And over those 2 weeks, they sent out little axons and dendrites, and they started tickling each other, and they found each other, and they spontaneously wired up. And so you can get network activity. It's not as complex, and it's in many ways different from what you would find in the brain. But at the sort of single synapse level, it's a good model for what's going on in the brain. Oh, yeah. So, you know, if you think about it, yeah. So we have 30,000 genes in our genome, and we have 100 trillion neurons in our brain. This tells you that the wiring of each neuron cannot possibly be specified by the genome. All the genome does is set up the rules. It tells the neurons how to behave, and then the neurons of their own are able to find each other and wire up into a brain. And so this is built into their structure. And so when you grow them in a dish, as far as they're concerned, they're just following the rules, and they start to put out these processes and try to find each other and start to communicate and build networks. Because the conditions aren't as favorable as they are inside of a brain, you know, it's not any time that we're going to get real brains in the dish, but people are working on trying to develop more, ever more realistic cell culture models where you have three-dimensional matrices and the right nutrients and just the right growth factors. And one hope is to start to try to grow little circuits in the dish that start to behave a little bit like a little chunk of brain. And over time, we'll get better at that and grow ever more realistic brain models in a dish. And that's another thing that's happening, and it's very exciting. We're doing this both with mouse neurons and with human neurons.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, we can talk later.
Okay, thanks.